KBOO radio station is located in Portland, Oregon, in Multnomah County. We honor the indigenous people whose traditional and ancestral homelands we stand on, the Multnomah, Kathlamet, Clackamas, Tumwater, Watlala bands of the Chinook, the Tualatin, Kalapuya, and many other indigenous nations of the Willamette and Columbia River regions. It is important to acknowledge the ancestors of this land and to recognize that we are here because of the sacrifices forced upon them. In remembering these communities, we honor their legacy, their lives, and their descendants with the forming of relationship to each other and the living world. We establish and support harmony within ourselves and set the stage for practice.
What makes you such a threat?
We choose direct to be who we are. We know the difference between the reality of freedom and the illusion of freedom. There's a way to live with Earth and a way not to live with Earth. We choose the way of Earth. It's about power.
Joshua.
Betu washtelo tayan wa chianke chante washte na pe chusa pielo le chante itaha awogalake le unkipiki he washtelo ambeto kile washtekte. Greetings and good day and welcome, my relatives. I shake your hands with a good heart. It is good for all of us to be here. Today will be a good day. You're listening to First Voices Radio and Teokasin Ghost Horse, sending you greetings and strength from the highlands of the Esopus, or what Americans and Dutch call the Catskill Mountains. Regardless, it is the highlands of the Esopus in the lands of the Munsee-speaking Lenape. This is an all-native hosted, all-native produced First Voices Radio, and Liz Hilf is the producer of First Voices Radio, and Karen Ramirez is our studio engineer. Our guest today, Daryl LaRue, is a French-Canadian scholar, an associate professor in the School of Political Studies at the University of Ottawa, whose work on the changing dynamics of white settler identities has been widely published, including his 2019 book Distorted Descent and the July 14, 2023 American Indian Culture and Research Journal article State Recognition and the Dangers of Race Shifting. This is an excerpt from the article. Since the 1970s, a high-profile movement actively trying to reconstitute the Abenaki people in Vermont has emerged. St. Francis Sokoki Band of Abenakis of Vermont, now Abenaki Nation of Mississauga, based in Swanton in Franklin County, was the first self-identified Abenaki tribe in the state, dating back to its formal incorporation in 1974. Since then, at least 16 other separate entities have emerged in the state to represent Abenaki people, all claiming to be descendants of the hitherto unknown population of Abenaki, who inhabited the state in the mid-19th century. In 2011 and 12, the state of Vermont formally recognized four tribes, all of which have their origins in an original Swanton-based organization. State recognition was the culmination of over 35 years of effort by the Abenaki Nation of Mississauga, or ANM, and allied organizations. This, quote, revitalization movement, unquote, as ANM called it in its 1982 petition for federal recognition, has led to several significant gains by the organizations, including millions of dollars in state and federal educational funding, lifetime fishing and hunting licenses for members, and authorization for its members to sell products under the Federal Indian Arts and Crafts Act of 1990. More than anything, the tribes have been almost universally welcomed by Vermonters as a salve for the region's history of colonialism. The most notable exception has been vocal and consistent opposition by the actual descendants of the Abenaki people, who inhabited the Green Mountain State for much of the 17th and 18th centuries, organized primarily by Odonak across the border in Quebec, who maintained that they shared no kinship relations whatsoever. I began talking with Daryl LaRue. Daryl LaRue is here with First Voices Radio. Great honor to welcome you. When did you begin your research and what compelled you to continue this research?
So I started this research. I wouldn't say by coincidence, but it kind of grew organically out of the research I was already doing. So I'm French Canadian from a region in what is considered Northern Ontario. And I just started really through my graduate studies looking at the role that French Canadians played in settler colonialism and in contemporary forms of racism and racial violence in Canadian society. And in particular, you know, I wanted to sort of figure out the role that different people in my family have played historically. And so that's kind of where my interest, I guess you could say, comes from when it comes to genealogy and sort of historical work in the archives. I'm not a historian by training. I do work more from a sociological, anthropological perspective, but I think it's really important to do some historical work as well. And so, you know, I was researching some of the ways that French Canadians or Quebecois people have, been involved in settler colonialism and are involved in settler colonialism today. And that's really when I started to see that there was this growth of new organizations in Quebec, but also in other parts of Canada. And so that led me to write the book that I published. And I think our first interview was after the publication of my book, which is called Distorted Descent, White Claims to Indigenous Identity. And it was in, you know, researching my book that I really figured out in a way how genealogy plays into this movement today, where there are a few hundred thousand white French Canadians like myself who are claiming that they're Indigenous based largely on ancestry in the 1600s. And I think what's most important to realize when it comes to the opposition to that movement is that it is opposed strongly and vocally by what we call here First Nations. So Native American tribes in particular throughout the eastern provinces where this movement is really strong. And so since the publication of my book, I've continued that line of research, but instead of focusing only on the strength of sort of the genealogical records and how they get used today, I'm also looking at the creation of family lore. I'm sure that you're aware of this, and these are the types of stories we hear a lot about the Indian princess and et cetera, et cetera. And so I realize that sometimes people make these claims without any genealogical substantiation or any bother doing genealogical work. And it's really just about a story that circulates in a family at a given moment in time. And then becomes this truth, if you will, that the family carries around. And so we see that with Elizabeth Warren and her story about, being Cherokee in Delaware, which is not true. And a range of others that I've been studying more recently.
You know, this recent phenomenon I'm well aware of here in the States, and mm-hmm. I'm sure you're describing something in Canada that maybe people weren't so aware until maybe you brought out, the book came out. And I knew this was going on, but no one was taking a stand to call it out, such as you have. Native peoples, in a sense, were not listened to because it's been ongoing. Yeah. Since I found out about Canada especially about the 60s scoop, as you're aware of, and especially with the unidentified grave markers of children throughout Canada that's being researched and uncovered now. But I'm also wondering, you know, when a person claims to be Métis and the Aboriginal rights movement there, Métis Aboriginal rights movement, the Eastern Métis seem to have something a little different flavor, maybe a tact about becoming Indigenous, so to speak, Aboriginal, where the Western Métis have been more or less recognized by other First Nations.
Yes. Well, and I think that's what the key is, what you just pointed out. So this sort of quote-unquote Eastern Métis movement, as I've discussed it in my research, it usually involves claims to being Métis. Now, the Métis itself, the word, it means mixed in French. So on a very basic level, there are people who are saying, well, since I'm mixed going back 12 generations, then that means I'm Métis, right? Or it means I'm mixed and thus Indigenous. Now, you have an actual Métis nation, a people, if you will, that are based, were historically based largely out of southern Manitoba, but also right into North Dakota, the Turtle Mountain Chippewa tribe. There are lots of actual Métis people who live there now who intermarried with Chippewa people. But that's actually the community with the largest number of Mishif speakers. And Mishif is a language that mixes French and Plains Cree primarily. And so the largest number, I think there are a few hundred speakers at Turtle Mountain Chippewa Reservation. And so that's just across the border, right, from Manitoba. So this sort of Plains-based Métis people are recognized by the Canadian state and by different Canadian provinces, by the courts, by First Nations people, because historically they had alliances with First Nations people. So if we look at specifically in Manitoba, then into Saskatchewan, they had a military alliance with the Plains Cree and the Soto, who are sort of the northern Chippewa, if you will, and also the Assiniboine, so the Nakota, as they're also known. And so they had a military alliance going back to about 1820. And that military alliance, the Iron Confederacy, existed for decades. And that was First Nations sort of recognizing their kin and also the Métis as a distinct people. And so that's really what marks the Métis, you know, as a distinct Indigenous people, a post-contact people, right? They're not the only post-contact people in sort of Native America, if you will. But they're one in Canada that is well known because they lead a couple of major resistances along with First Nation allies in 1869-70 and also in 1885. The 1885 battle is the first battle really where the Canadian military is used domestically within the boundaries of what is now Canada, in this case against Indigenous people, and they massacre dozens and dozens of fighters, but also a lot of innocent people and bystanders who are Métis and First Nations on the plains in what is now Saskatchewan. So that's what makes the sort of Western Métis unique and recognized in Canada. Now, what the Eastern Métis, and I say that, you know, I should say Eastern Métis in quotation marks, because it's really a recent invention. So we're talking the last decade, two decades at most, where, you know, there are these academics, these sort of political leaders of this movement who are arguing that, in fact, there were mixed people in New France back in the 16 and 1700s who predate even the Western Métis. And the fact that there were these mixed people means that today they have descendants who should consider themselves Eastern Métis. The major problem with that argument is the people who are mixed either completely over time, and we're talking here hundreds of years, they either completely assimilated to mainstream society, and so there are Quebecois people, French Canadian, etc., or in the case of the sort of early contact period, you know, these Frenchmen would have children with First Nations women, and those children were raised in their First Nations communities, right? And so they completely integrated into First Nations communities. And so their descendants today are largely still considered First Nations. So whether they're Abenaki, whether they're Algonquin, you know, different Anishinaabe people, whether they're, you know, Innu, which are the Indigenous peoples on the North Shore of the St. Lawrence. And so, you know, there's this, I hesitate to call it a debate because, I mean, it's fairly settled in terms of what you read in academia when it comes to Indigenous Native American studies, when it comes to First Nations positions on this. The federal government doesn't recognize any of these groups in the Eastern Métis movement, and neither do any of the provincial governments. So they have no recognition whatsoever, except because of this focus on self-identification on an institutional level, individuals who are part of this movement do often get resources, you know, jobs, scholarships, bursaries, other forms of funding that are reserved for Indigenous peoples, that Indigenous peoples have fought, you know, for quite a long time to have in place, to support, you know, their needs in their community. And so we do unfortunately see a lot of jobs in the federal government, in academia, in the arts, funding agencies, and et cetera, going to individuals who really aren't considered Indigenous by anybody except themselves and the groups that they're members of.
Mm. In a recent interview, I viewed you saying something about the appropriation of symbols such as flags. And as you say, ID cards are now, people are interested here actually because some movement of Métis is happening in states, Vermont and New Hampshire, places. What happens when you become a member of this Eastern Métis nation, so to speak, and what brings about these identity cards or identity?
Sure. Yeah. So, I mean, the Eastern Métis movement, as I call it, and others do as well, it's not really centralized. So there isn't like a specific body, you know. There are lots of different organizations who I would categorize as part of that movement. And one of the things that's, I think, become more obvious over time as the sort of opposition to their claims has really become more, I guess, mainstream, is that many of the individuals involved have started to shift their claims. So instead of just saying they're Métis or Eastern Métis or whatever the case is, they've started to say that they're Algonquin. They've started to say that they're Mi'kmaq. They've started to say that they're Abenaki. Right. And so there's a way in which they're making the claim based on the same, they're all French descendants. So they're all people who are descended from the earliest French colonizers in New France. So essentially in the 1600s, the early 1600s. And so we all share the same ancestors to some extent, because it was quite a small group of French people who settled in New France compared to what happened in New England, for instance, and what happened in the South in Virginia. And so, you know, there's a small group of people. We share many of those key people as ancestors, which means that we're all going to be related to a handful of or part of a handful of the Indigenous women who married Frenchmen in the first few decades. There weren't that many women who did. But those who did, for instance, I'm related to three Algonquin women who married Frenchmen. Those three women were all born before 1650. And that's about the average for a French descendant today. For a long time, you know, for hundreds of years, that didn't in any way make you Indigenous. Mm-hmm. It made you, you know, Quebecois, French Canadian, depending on where you lived. But more recently, we see that people make the shift. And I think that's what brought me to the so-called Abenaki tribes in Vermont and New Hampshire, was the fact that they were French descendants. So these are Franco-Americans, people who are descendant from Quebecois immigrants to New England. Basically, the movement really starts in the 1820s. And it goes on all the way to about 1910. And so historians today estimate that about 500,000 Quebecois people immigrated to the United States. It's not to the United States, to New England. There's some other people who go to the Midwest, but 500,000. And that's why you'll see in states like Maine and Rhode Island and Massachusetts, Vermont, you'll see a lot of French Canadian last names, you know, so governors who have, you know, Quebecois names, or at least last names, maybe not first names, but sometimes. And so that's both historically and in the present. And that's because of the proximity, obviously, of the border. You know, the fact that these New England states are on the border with Quebec largely, but also with New Brunswick, where there's a lot of French descendants, Acadians as well. And so that's really what brought me to the Vermont and New Hampshire groups was, hey, wait a second, this sounds a lot like what's happening in my research in the Canadian provinces, but instead of saying that they're Métis or Algonquin, they're saying they're Abenaki because they live in the historical territory of the Abenaki people. And politically, that's the claim that makes the most sense.
Incredible. Now, yeah.
And what I just recently published an article in the American Indian Culture and Research Journal, which is published out of UCLA. And, you know, I did a deep dive, I guess you could say, into the sort of records of these Abenaki tribes in Vermont in particular. And what became really, really telling is that in everything that they have presented, and we're talking literally at this point, thousands of pages, they did a petition for federal recognition or federal acknowledgement in 1982, an addendum in 1986, another addendum in 95, and then they got the rejection in 2007. They did a state recognition sort of paperwork once that sort of process was started in 2010. And in all this documentation that they presented, they've never once had to or even attempted to substantiate their claims genealogically, even though one would expect that that would be kind of important to, and it is important to the federal acknowledgement process, and that's why they were rejected. They weren't able to demonstrate that they're actually the descendants of the Abenaki people who lived in Vermont in the 17 and 1800s, and they're not. They claim that they're the descendants of a hidden Abenaki community of, and their claims have shifted. In 1982, it was 15 families. In 1986, it became 200 families in northwestern Vermont. So all of a sudden, their historical community grew, you know, we're looking at 10, 12 times with the matter of 4 years. And then back in 1995, they brought it back to about 20 families. And so their own claims have shifted remarkably over the years, and it's because, honestly, they're making it up. You know, they have tried as much as they can. I imagine that there are people involved in this movement who believe that they're the descendants of Abenaki people. There are others who might know that they're not, and so they find ways to kind of avoid ever having to discuss that openly and or any questions that might be uncomfortable about that. But, you know, when you look at the actual records, it's very clear that they are the descendants of white French Canadians who came to Vermont in the 1800s.
Errol LaRue is an associate professor in the School of Political Studies at the University of Ottawa, French Canadian from Northern Ontario.
Outside my window, there's a tiredness in my bones. I feel helpless and alone. Deep within our mother's womb lie the bodies of children in unmarked hidden dooms. Purpose and reason, that's what they say that you'll get when you have kids. And I did. Bruises and fresh open wounds reveal stories that were told to me in room. I knew an old man sit in his armchair. Sometimes at night I'd catch him crying, sitting there. He cried because when he was a kid, he spoke his own language and then lost his voice and part of his own lineage. This land is your land. This land mother was stolen from their land. And here I stand. It's dark out. Storms raging, static noise transmission on the radio. There's an aching in my bones. I feel lost and far from home. Purpose and reason, that's what they say that you'll get when you have kids. And I did. I'm not sad. Devastated underneath all that pain, heartbeats of cold rain. I know a black woman who sits at a death chair. Sometimes she cries hidden there because fear became her worst nightmare. She cries because her only son was killed by a shotgun. Another senseless tragedy triggered by police brutality. This land is your land. This land is mine. This land was made for you and me. A poor choice of words by Woody Guthrie. This land was taken and built on slavery. One family had their land stolen. The other was stolen from their land. And here I stand.
Stolen Lands by Julian Taylor from the album Beyond the Reservoir. And welcome back to First Voices Radio. My name is Teokazin Ghost Horse. We continue the second half hour with Daryl LaRue with an article published in the American Indian Cultural Research Journal, State Recognition and the Dangers of Race Shifting. Daryl LaRue is an associate professor in the School of Political Studies at the University of Ottawa, French Canadian from Northern Ontario. Just a note, you mentioned 18, 20, 10, 500,000 influx of French Canadians. So yeah. It seems to be like, okay, at this time in 1900, there were less than a quarter of a million Native people left in the United States from all the decimation and massacre. So I wanted to actually go back to what are they protecting? Because I'm all this time you're speaking of like, what are they really protecting? What's going on there? And when you talk to them, I get a backlash. And I like, okay, this is meaning there is something hidden to me. Because, you know, they could actually set down, which we'll talk about later, this mutual agreement of understanding that came between the Western Métis and the First Nations. I really want to know what's going on underneath all of this, why they are doing this.
Yeah. I mean, you know, ultimately I do too, which is partly why I'm working on this. And, you know, I come up with a few, I think, interrelated explanations in this recent article. I'm not suggesting that I have the answer, because I think it's very complex. There's obviously some complex sort of social psychological things going on here that are a little bit outside of my expertise, but I'll give it a try and you can tell me what you think. And so, I mean, the three major lines that I take in the research, there's the big picture. And so what happens in the 50s, 60s, especially in the US into the 70s, is that you have this sort of civil rights movement that's shaking things up politically to some extent, you know, and some people would say a lot, some people would say not enough, but it's shaking things up. And that also includes the Red Power movement, obviously. And so you have this civil rights movement. And one of the things that we see happening, and sociologists in the US have documented this through the census and other means, is that in the US, you have all of these white Americans who start to hyphenate their identities. And so they start reclaiming a particular sort of place in Europe, or you know, European identity. So you have Irish Americans and Italian Americans and Polish Americans, and you know, the list goes on. So these all of a sudden, these white Americans are trying to turn themselves into ethnic minorities. And one of the reasons why, you know, sociologists have explained that happening is because this is at a time when African Americans, Native Americans, Asian Americans, etc., are really pushing back at the history of racism in the United States, and the history of colonialism. And so white people, in a way, take a step back and think, well, if I can disassociate myself from whiteness and from dominance, maybe that's something that would be helpful to my sort of social and political identity. And so you really see the creation of all these organizations that are there to help white people connect with their European roots away from whiteness, so that you can kind of say, well, my people came here and they suffered the potato famine, right? They were refugees. They were people who suffered too. How could they be colonizers? How could they be? They had no choice but to leave. They had to flee, etc. Right. So you can imagine that that's a particularly attractive strategy. And again, it's not that people sit down and they think, what am I going to do here? It's a social movement again, right? There's things that are happening in society and people start changing their identities, the way they understand history. And so that's one thing that happens. You see that there's a really big move away from just this kind of white identity. And the irony is that their ancestors, so these Irish people and Polish people and et cetera, who arrive in the, you know, latter half of the 1800s, they did everything they could to be considered white, right? And so the other thing that happens is those who are able to sort of trace their ancestry even further back, so whether it's to the Mayflower and the New England, you know, the Puritans, or whether it's down in Virginia, Jamestown, et cetera, they start finding these quote-unquote Indian grandmothers. And so we see this in the census. There's been really great studies of the census that show that by 1980, the number of people who are identifying as having Native American ancestry, it's off the charts. We're at 5.2 million people in 1980, right? But historically, there's no more than a million in the United States in the previous census. So who are these people? And what sociologists and demographers have shown is that those people who are claiming that they have Native American ancestry, but still claim that their quote unquote race is white, and there's millions of them, they're middle-class white people who are unhappy, you know, with their lot in life for whatever reason. And so they start to sort of claim, at least hesitantly, they're not saying they're Native American, but they're saying they have Native American ancestry, but they're still identifying as white. Now, that group today has completely shifted the demographic makeup if you read a census, because they're almost 20 million now in the last census. Imagine, right? That's an enormous amount of people in the United States who are saying they have Native American ancestry, when really we're talking about a Native American population of federally recognized tribal members of, you know, 1.5 to 2 million people at most. And so big changes that are happening at that point in time. And so that's one of the ways that I try to explain what's happening, is that there's a particular sort of series of sort of social and political changes that lead, in this case, white Americans to desire a different identity, And so my reading of that and the reading that sociologists present is that really it's an escape from any sort of accountability in these sort of racist relations, colonial relations that exist. And so that's really the beginning of these groups in Vermont. It starts sitting around, this is according to their own petition in 1982 to the federal government, but it starts by a French-Canadian man, Homer St. Francis, and a few of his buddies sitting around a kitchen table talking about, you know, who they are and how poor they are and what they can do about that in the late 1960s. And it leads to them incorporating in 1974 and calling themselves Abenaki, because the Abenaki where they live, Swanton, Vermont, in the northwest, along sort of the county that's right alongside Lake Champlain, mm-hmm. so across mm-hmm. the lake from New York State, it's actually Swanton is where there was a historical Abenaki village in the 1700s. So they imagine themselves as replacing the Abenaki and being the actual Abenaki today, which is, you know, that's a function of settler colonialism, you know, a settler's imagining that they're the real natives. And so it's at that particular moment in the 60s and 70s where this movement is birthed. It doesn't really take on too much import until about the end of the 70s and then into the early 80s when they submit their petition for federal acknowledgement. So just to give you a sense, that's one of the lines, I guess, of argument that I take, the social and political sort of framework. Another line that I look at is one that I guess kind of makes sense on some level, but it wasn't one that I was particularly aware of prior to doing this research. So what people who've been studying these new movements have demonstrated is that states with the smallest proportion of Native Americans and or the smallest number of federally recognized tribes are the states that are inundated with these claims. So either new false groups, so especially in the Southeast, but not only, also you can see here in the Northeast, and or individuals on the census making these claims. So it's much more likely if you live in a state that has very few Native Americans relative to others that you're going to feel comfortable saying you're Native American. You're not going to be challenged. You know, less people around you are going to know what it means to be Native American, what it means to live on a reservation, what it means to, you know, be part of a tribal government. And so it's easier to get away with these claims, which means people are more likely to do it. And that's what you see happening in Vermont, right? So Vermont doesn't have a federally recognized tribe. The Abenaki, who are the descendants of the Abenaki people who lived throughout New England, they live in Quebec. They live on two reserves, which are they're called in Canada. Odonak, which has about 2,000, a little bit more than 2,000 citizens, and Wolanak, which is just down the St. Lawrence River from Odonak. And many of, and this is something that's key, many of their citizens, so the Abenaki people, do live in the United States. So there's a large population, a couple hundred people who live in the Albany urban sort of district. And they're the descendants of an Abenaki population largely that lived in the Adirondacks in the 1800s. Hmm. And then there's also a large population in Waterbury, Connecticut, about 100. And then also a few hundred in Orleans County, primarily in Vermont. And these are all individuals who have Indian status, according to the Canadian government, but they're dual citizens. They're Canadian and Americans, and most of them have only ever lived in the United States. And so the Abenaki people haven't left the United States. It's true that they're based in Canada, but the story that the fake tribes tell in New Hampshire and Vermont is that they completely left. And they're the descendants of a population that was hiding. And so they're not related to the quote unquote Canadian Abenaki. And so it becomes sort of a national issue, you know, because there's this border that has really infringed upon Abenaki sovereignty. And that's been very useful for these fake groups in Vermont and New Hampshire to say, well, what do they have to say about us? They're in Canada, they're Canadian, you know, whereas their territory is just as much in the United States as it is in Canada. And obviously, they're not the only tribe to have that reality, right? There are many of them throughout the West in particular, where, for instance, even where you are in New York with the Mohawk, right, who have territory across the border. And that makes things complicated. And so the lack of a tribal presence in a state really dictates how much this sort of type of movement can take off. And so by taking off, that can lead to these problematic state recognition processes. And that's the third part of my argument. So the first part, again, is these changes that are happening with white identities. The second part is the lack of a Native American presence in a state, in this case, Vermont, New Hampshire. And then the third one is the state recognition process itself. And in Vermont, I think I point out in my article, it's full of conflicts of interest. And so for whatever reason, in 2010, once they fail at federal recognition, the House, the Senate in Vermont seems open to this idea of recognizing these tribes because they're not going to be able to open a casino, right? And that's the fear in a lot of the places in the Northeast. That was apparently the goal of the founder of the organization back in the 60s and 70s, this idea of, you know, making themselves wealthy through a casino. But in any case, they set up this state recognition process with basically a commission for Native American affairs that's completely staffed by people from these fake organizations. They get to replace themselves also. So they can name people, only they can name people to the commission. And so they just name their family members and or people who are in their so-called tribe. They have brought in outsiders once in a while. There is actually a Native American woman, I think she might be Lakota, who was on the commission and recently stepped down because she said these people are fakes. You know, I can't work with them anymore. So you take a risk when you bring in actual Native Americans to work with you because they might actually call you out, right? And that's what happened. And so it's, you know, even the outside, the reviewers, so to be able to get recognized, you put together an application and there are these three outside independent reviewers. But in my article, I demonstrate that six of the seven reviewers who've been hired for these four tribes have been recognized. They all work for the tribes. They've worked for them in the past. One of them not only is a tribal member, but he wrote the applications from two other tribes. And he reviewed other ones, you know, and he was on the commission at one point. And so it's just, it's really kind of a joke, you know, like it's once you start kind of scratching at the surface and you're like, well, how did this happen? And you're left wondering, like, who allowed this to happen? There's no rigor in the process. There's no independence. Like I said, it makes the state of Vermont like it makes it a bit of a laughing stock, really, the state recognition process. And so state recognition processes aren't necessarily problematic on their own, but, you know, they've really started to come in as well since the 70s and 80s. You see that there are more and more states with state recognition processes, but the states with the largest populations of federally recognized tribes, they don't have state recognition processes because those tribes lobby them hard to say, no, you don't get to recognize if there are other Native Americans in our territory. We get to do that, right? And so like Oklahoma does not have a process. North Dakota, South Dakota do not have processes, right? And so it's not surprising that a place like Vermont that may like to think of itself as a bit progressive, as, you know, sort of fighting the good fight of social justice, or like, well, we're going to put in a process that really just allows these people to decide who's part of their community. And meanwhile, these people are white Franco-Americans.
It's incredible. I'm just kind of like queasy a little bit trying to figure out what question to ask next. The few minutes we have left, Daryl LaRue's, these ideas that are very racist, the social phenomenon, their populations of more, you know, as you said, several hundred thousand, tens of thousands of Métis that are much bigger than First Nations numbers themselves. And I'm getting to a place now where I'm really thinking about in the United States, it's called pretend Indians. Mm-hmm. And they're being called out. And as you say, they're appropriating, and this fits into a great Vine DeLora quote that I'm going to mention after we talk. And it's hiding the racism and the colonialism, but it's ongoing. And this is not going to go away because of some ruling, because the people themselves want to usurp any native. It's been since they got here, right? That we weren't real. Yeah. No human beings. Yeah. Goes back to the 1493 papal bulls. It's ongoing. So what do we do as Native people? And you seeing this as a French Canadian, you know, without the border, let's erase the border, because this is both sides of that border.
Right. Well, I mean, in my work, one thing that I try to do is to think about the bigger, like the problem. That's why I talk about it as a movement. And I think that one thing that can happen when you're working to, you know, expose the inner workings of a particular movement is you definitely can get caught up in the individuals who are involved in that movement, you know, and trying to like focus on, I don't know, you know, whatever the case is, doing research on individuals, figuring out what their claims are, you know, figuring out how they're harming other people they work with, particularly Indigenous peoples, because that's what we see. And I'm not saying that that shouldn't be done. I just think that my approach more often than not has really been to think about this as a social and a political phenomenon that needs those types of solutions, right? It needs social and political solutions, not just focus on sort of bad apples, if you will. Mm-hmm. And because the more that you scratch at it, the more you realize, wow, you know, this is, wow, you know, it's a huge problem. There's so many people making these claims who have influential positions, who make decisions that are going to impact the lives of Indigenous peoples and have been impacting them, often in quite, quite negative ways. And so I think that it's important not to lose sight of that, and to come up with, you know, solutions, ideas, approaches that put as much sort of power into the hands of Indigenous peoples, Native Americans, into the hands of tribes, into the hands of organizations run by Native Americans, and that we trust that Native Americans, First Nations people where I am, they understand who's Indigenous to their territories. You know, they understand who's part of their communities. They often are looking for those members of the communities who've been taken, who, you know, have were taken away because of different policies. They're, you know, generous in terms of what I've seen in the conversations I have in terms of welcoming these those people back. And so I think that our institutions definitely need to understand that they really need to heed the voices of Native Americans and the concerns about tribal sovereignty and self-determination that are really at the forefront of opposition to this movement.
This is so great. Thank you for this time, Darryl LaRue, and the article you're talking about. Would you repeat that so people can really look it up and do their own research?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. So the article is called State Recognition and the Dangers of Race Shifting. It actually had a subtitle, but it got dropped. The Case of Vermont was the subtitle. I don't know how it got dropped or when it did, but it did. But it looks specifically at Vermont, and there's some ties to the New Hampshire groups. It's in the American Indian Culture and Research Journal, their latest issue, which you can access easily online, and it's open access. So you can see the entire journal now is open access. You can get the PDF on your computer. Or you can just check it out on their web browser.
Can I give it a subtitle? How can one?
What would it be?
How can you live with yourself?
All right, I'll take that under advisement for another version.
Good protection for you and your good thoughts that you're sending out there to really protect the Native people here. Mm. Our responsibility we have as Native people is basically and primarily the earth. Where are you as Indigenous peoples that you claim? Are you showing up like places like Standing Rock? Are you showing up when the pipeline and, you know, the damage to the land comes? Those are my thoughts. But thank you again for helping us understand, even those of us who are behind the modern information that comes out, because the community at home is concerned about how are we treating the earth. So this is all part of that understanding that we have an origin to earth. And people say, we're all Indigenous to Earth, but I say, no. Are you behaving as if you're Indigenous and protecting the Earth and stopping damage that we are doing as a species? But it's an honor, Darryl. Again, thank you so much for doing your work.
Thank you so much, Kissin, being here. I really appreciate it. Yes. Good luck with the show.
Thank you so much.
All right. Bye now.
I'd like to quote from the book Playing Indian by Vine Deloria's son, Philip Deloria. This story is a very different one. It is more tightly linked to destiny, to Indians who simply vanish, to the relativity of culture and meaning, to a long-standing license to make oneself over. Americans have often been inclined to keep the narratives of American nationhood and American character away from each other, and yet the two stories are inseparable. Playing Indian then reflects one final paradox. The defining pairing of American truth with American freedom rests on the ability to wield power against Indians, social, military, economic, and political, while simultaneously drawing power from them. Indianness may have existed primarily as a cultural artifact in American society, but has also helped create those other forms of power which have been turned back on Native people. The dispossessing of Indians exists in tension with being aboriginally true. The embracing of Indians exists in equal tension with the freedom to become new. And the terms are interchangeable, intricate relations between destruction and creativity. For both Indian and non-Indian Americans are themselves suspended in an uneasy alliance. And so while Indian people have lived out a collection of historical nightmares in the material world, they have also haunted a long night of American dreams. As many Native people have observed, to be American is to be unfinished. And although that state is powerful and creative, it carries with it nightmares all its own. Thank you for joining us here on First Voices Radio. My name is Teokasen Ghost Horse. Toksha Ake Wachyank Telo.